Richie Trelawney were with Buddy, and between the gram of coke and the 6 bottles of Texas Driver Buddy had procured for the occasion, they were feeling pretty much reet and complete. They had come to do a little dirty boogie on Arnie Cunningham's Plymouth. "Listen, if you guys get caught, I'm going to lose my job," Sandy said nervously. He was the only one cold sober, and he was regretting ever having mentioned that Cunningham was parking his heap here. The thought that he might go to jail as well had fortunately not occurred to him. "If you or any of your mission fucking possible force are caught, the secretary will disavow you ever fucking lived," Moochie said from the back seat, and there was more laughter. Sandy looked around for other cars, witnesses, but there were no planes due for more than an hour, and the parking lot was as deserted as the mountains of the moon. The weather had turned very cold, and a wind as keen as a fresh razor blade whined across the runways and taxiways and hooted miserably between the ranks of empty cars. Above and to his left, the APCO sign banged restlessly back and forth. "You can laugh, you retard," Sandy said. "I never saw you, that's all. If you get caught, I'll say I was taking a crap." "Jesus, what a baby," Buddy said. He looked sorrowful. "I never thought you were such a baby, Sandy, honest."
"Arf, arf," Richie barked, and there was more laughter. "Roll over and play Dead for Daddy Warbucks, Sandy."
Sandy flushed. "I don't care," he said. "Just be careful."
"We will, man," Buddy said, sincerely.
He had saved back a 7th bottle of Texas Driver and a pretty decent toot of nose candy. Now he handed both up to Sandy.
"Here, enjoy yourself."
Sandy grinned in spite of himself.
"Okay,"
he said, and added, just so they'd know he was no sad sack,
"do a good job."
Buddy's smile hardened, became metallic. The light went out of his eyes. They became dull and dead and frightening.
"Oh, we will," he said. "We will."
The Camaro drifted into the parking lot. For a while, Sandy could follow its progress toward the back by the moving taillights, and then Buddy doused them. The sound of the motor burbling through twin glass-pack mufflers came back for a few moments on the wind, and then that sound was gone, too. Sandy dumped the coke out on the counter by his portable TV and tooted it with a rolled-up dollar bill. Then he got into the Texas Driver. He knew that being discovered drunk on the job would also get him canned, but he didn't much care. Being drunk was better than being cat-jumpy and always staring around for one of the 2 gray airport security cars. The wind was blowing toward him, and he could hear. Too much he could hear. A tinkle of breaking glass, muffled laughter, a loud, metallic thonk, more breaking glass, a pause. Low voices drifting to him on the cold wind. He was unable to pick up the individual words. They were distorted. Suddenly there was a perfect fusillade of blows. Sandy winced at the sound, more breaking glass in the dark, and a tinkle of metal falling on the pavement. Chrome or something, he supposed. He found himself wishing Buddy had brought more coke. Coke was sort of cheery stuff, and he sure could use some cheering up right about now. It sounded as if some pretty bad stuff was going on down at the far end of that parking lot. And then a louder voice, urgent and commanding. Buddy's for sure.
"Do it there!"
A mutter of protest. Buddy again.
"Never mind that. On the dashboard, I said."
Another mutter. Buddy.
"I don't give a shit."
And for some reason, this produced a stifle of laughter. Sweaty now in spite of the knifing cold, Sandy suddenly slid the glass window shut and snapped on the TV. He drank deeply, grimacing at the heavy taste of the mixed fruit juice and cheap wine. He didn't care for it, but Texas Driver was what they all drank when they weren't drinking Iron City beer. And what was he supposed to do? Make out he was better than them or something? That would get him fried sooner or later. Buddy didn't like wimps. He drank and began to feel a little better, or at least a little drunker. When one of the airport security cars did pass, he hardly even flinched. The cop raised a hand to Sandy. Sandy raised a hand right back, just as cool as you could want. About 15 minutes after it had cruised toward the back of the lot, the blue Camaro reappeared, this time in the exit lane. Buddy sat cool and relaxed behind the wheel, a 3/4 empty bottle of Driver propped in his crotch. He was smiling, and Sandy noted uneasily how bloodshot and weird his eyes looked. That wasn't just wine, and it wasn't just coke, either. Buddy Repperton was no one to fuck with. Cunningham would find that out, if nothing else.
All taken care of, my good man, Buddy said.
Good, Sandy said, and tried a smile. It felt a little sick. He had no feelings about Cunningham one way or another, and he was not a particularly imaginative person, but he could make a good guess about how Cunningham was going to feel when he saw what had come of all his careful work restoring that red and white Plymouth. Still, it was Buddy's business, not his.
Good, he said again. Keep your jock on, man, Richie said, and giggled.
Sure, Sandy said. He was glad they were going. Maybe he wouldn't hang around Vandenberg's happy gas so much after this. Maybe after this, he didn't want to. This was heavy shit. Too heavy, maybe. And maybe he would pick up a couple of night courses, too. He'd have to give this job up, but maybe that wouldn't be so bad either. It was a pretty dull fucking job. Buddy was still looking at him, smiling that hard, gonzo smile, and Sandy took a big drink at Texas Driver. He nearly gagged. For an instant, he had an image of puking down into Buddy's upturned face, and his unease became terror.
If the cops get in on it, Buddy said, you don't know nothing. You didn't see nothing. Like you said, you had to go and take a crap around 9:30.
Sure, Buddy.
We all wore our widow mittens. We didn't leave any prints.
Sure.
Stay cool, Sandy, Buddy said softly.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Camaro began to roll again. Sandy raised the gate with the manual button. The car headed toward the airport exit road at a sedate pace. Someone called, "Arf! Arf!" The sound drifted back to Sandy against the wind. Troubled, he sat down to watch TV. Shortly before the rush of customers who had come in on the 1040 from Cleveland began to arrive, he poured the rest of the driver out of the window and onto the ground. He didn't want it anymore. Chapter 26. Christine Laid Low. The next day, Arnie and Lee rode out to the airport together after school to pick up Christine. They were planning on a trip to Pittsburgh to do some early Christmas shopping, and they were looking forward to doing it together. It seemed somehow terribly adult. Arnie was in a fine mood on the bus, making up fanciful little vignettes about their fellow passengers and making her laugh in spite of her period, which was usually depressing and almost always painful. The fat lady in the man's work shoes was a lapsed nun, he said. The kid in a cowboy hat was a hustler, and on and on. She got into the spirit of the thing, but was not as good at it as he. It was amazing, the way he had come out of his shell, the way he had bloomed. That was really the only word for it. She felt the smug, pleased satisfaction of a prospector who has suspected the presence of gold by certain signs and has been proved correct. She loved him, and she had been right to love him. They got off the bus at the terminal stop together and walked across the access road to the parking lot, hand in hand.
"This isn't bad," Lee said. It was the first time she had come out with him to pick up Christine. 25 minutes from school?"
"Yeah, it's okay," Arnie said. "It keeps peace in the family. That's the important thing. I'm telling you, when my mom got home that night and saw Christine in the driveway, she went totally bullshit."
Lee laughed, and the wind flipped her hair out behind her. The temperature had moderated from last night's bitter mid-teens, but it was still chilly. She was glad. Without a certain chill in the air, it didn't feel like Christmas shopping. Bad enough the decorations in Pittsburgh wouldn't be up yet. But it wasn't bad. It was good. And suddenly, she was glad about everything. Most of all, glad to be alive. And in love. She had thought about it, the way she loved him. She had had crushes before, and once in Massachusetts, she had thought she might be in love. But about this boy, there was simply no question. He troubled her sometimes. His interest in the car seemed almost obsessive. But even her occasional unease played a part in her feelings, which were richer than anything she had ever known. And part of it, she admitted to herself, was of course selfish. She had, in weeks only, begun to make him over, to complete him. They cut between the cars, headed for the 30-day section of the parking lot. Overhead, a U.S. air jet was coming in on its final approach, the thunder of its engines rolling away in great flat waves of sound. Arnie was saying something, but the plane obliterated his voice altogether after the first few words. Something about Thanksgiving dinner. And she turned to look at his face, secretly amused by his silently moving mouth. Then, quite suddenly, his mouth stopped moving. He stopped walking. His eyes opened wider, and then seemed to bulge. His mouth began to twist, and the hand holding Lee's suddenly clamped down ruthlessly, grinding her finger bones painfully together. "Arnie!" The jet roar was fading, but he seemed not to have heard. His hand clamped tighter. His mouth had slammed shut now, and it was knotted into an awful grimace of surprise and terror. She thought, "He's having a heart attack, stroke, something. Arnie, what's wrong?" she cried. "Arnie, ow, ow, that hurts!" For one unbearable moment, the pressure on the hand he had been holding so lightly and lovingly just before increased until it seemed that the bones would actually splinter and break. The high color in his cheeks was gone, and his skin was as leaden as a slate headstone. He said one word, "Christine," and suddenly let go of her. He ran, thumping his leg against the bumper of a Cadillac, spinning away, almost falling, catching himself and running forward again. She realized at last it was something about the car. The car, the car. Always it was the goddamn car. And a bitter anger rose in her that was both total and despairing. For the first time she wondered if it would be possible to love him, if Arnie would allow it. Her anger was quenched the instant she really looked and saw. Arnie ran to what remained of his car, hands out, and stopped so abruptly in front of it that the gesture seemed almost to be a horrified warding off, the classic movie pose of the hit-and-run victim an instant before the lethal collision. He stood that way for a moment, as if to stop the car, or the whole world. Then he lowered his arms. His Adam's apple lurched up and down twice as he struggled to swallow something back, a moan, a cry, and then his throat seemed to lock solid, every muscle standing out, each cord standing out, even the blood vessels standing out in perfect relief. It was the throat of a man trying to lift a piano. Lee walked slowly toward him. Her hand still throbbed, and tomorrow it would be swollen and virtually useless. But for now she had forgotten it. Her heart went out to him and seemed to find him. She felt his sorrow and shared it, or it seemed to her that she did. It was only later that she realized how much Arnie shut her out that day, how much of his suffering he elected to do alone, and how much of his hate he hid away.
"Arnie, who did it?"
she asked, her voice breaking with grief for him. No, she had not liked the car. But to see it reduced to this made her understand fully what Arnie's commitment had been. And she could hate it no longer. Or so she thought. Arnie made no answer. He stood looking at Christine, his eyes burning, his head slightly down. The windshield had been smashed through in two places. Handfuls of safety glass fragments were strewn across the slashed seat covers like trumpery diamonds. Half of the front bumper had been pried off and now dragged on the pavement, near a snarl of black wires like octopus tentacles. Three of the four side windows had also been broken. Holes had been punched through the sides of the body at waist level in ragged, wavering lines. It looked as if some sharp, heavy instrument, maybe the pry end of a tire iron, had been used. The passenger door hung open, and she saw that all the dashboard glass had been broken. Tufts and wads of stuffing were everywhere. The speedometer needle lay on the driver's side floor mat. Arnie walked slowly around his car, noting all of this. Lee spoke to him twice. He didn't answer, either time. Now the leaden color of his face was broken by two hectic, burning spots of flush riding high up on his cheekbones. He picked up the octopus thing that had been lying on the pavement, and she saw it was a distributor cap. Her father had pointed that out to her once when he had been tinkering with their car. He looked at it for a moment, as if examining an exotic zoological specimen,
and then threw it down. Broken Glass gritted under their heels. She spoke to him again. He didn't answer, and now, as well as a terrible pity for him, she began to feel afraid, too. She told Dennis Gilder later that it seemed, at least at the time, perfectly possible that he might have lost his mind. He booted a piece of chrome trim out of his way. It struck the cyclone fence at the back of the lot with a little tinkling sound. The taillights had been smashed, more trumpery gems, this time rubies, this time on the pavement instead of the seat.
"Arnie,"
she tried again. He stopped. He was looking in through the hole in the driver's side window. A terrible, low sound began to come from his chest, a jungle sound. She looked over his shoulder, saw, and suddenly felt a crazy need to laugh and scream and faint all at the same time. On the dashboard, she hadn't noticed at first. In the midst of the general destruction, she hadn't noticed what was on the dashboard, and she wondered, with vomit suddenly rising in her throat, who could be so low, so completely low, as to do such a thing to... "Shitters!" Arnie cried, and his voice was not his own. It was high and shrill and cracked with fury. Lee turned around and threw up, holding blindly onto the car next to Christine, seeing small white dots in front of her eyes that expanded like puffed rice. Dimly she thought of the county fair. Every year they'd haul an old junk car up onto a plank platform and lean a sledgehammer against it, and you got 3 swings for a quarter. The idea was to demolish the car, but not to... "You goddamn shitters!" Arnie screamed. "I'll get you! I'll get you if it's the last thing I do! If it's the last motherfucking thing I ever do!" Lee threw up again, and for one terrible moment found herself wishing that she had never, ever met Arnie Cunningham. Chapter 27. Arnie and Regina. He let himself into the house that night at 11:45. The clothes he had been wearing with the shopping trip to Pittsburgh in mind were grease and sweat-stained. His hands were more deeply grimed, and a shallow cut corkscrewed across the back of the left like a brand. His face looked haggard and stunned. There were dark circles under his eyes. His mother sat at the table, a game of solitaire laid out in front of her. She had been waiting for him to come home, and dreading it deeply at the same time. Lee had called and told her what had happened. The girl, who had impressed Regina as being quite a nice girl, if perhaps not quite good enough for her son, sounded as if she'd been crying. Regina, alarmed, had hung up as quickly as she could and had dialed Darnell's garage. Lee had told her Arnie had called for a tow truck from there and had ridden in with the driver. He had put her in a taxi over her protests. The phone had rung twice, and then a wheezy yet gravelly voice had said, "Yeah, Darnell's." She had hung up, realizing it would be a mistake to talk to him there, and it looked as if she and Mike had already made enough mistakes about Arnie and his car. She would wait until he came home, say what she had to say, looking him in the face. She said it now.
"Arnie, I'm sorry."
It would have been better if Mike could be here, too, but he was in Kansas City, attending a symposium on trade and the beginnings of free enterprise in the Middle Ages. He wouldn't be back until Sunday, unless this brought him home early. She thought it might. She realized, not without some rue, that she might just be awakening to the full seriousness of this situation.
"Sorry,"
Arnie echoed in a flat, accentless voice. "Yes, we... She couldn't go on. There was something terrible in the deadwood of his expression. His eyes were blanks. She could only look at him and shake her head, her eyes brimming, the hateful taste of tears in her nose and throat. She hated to cry, strong-willed, one of two girls in a Catholic family that consisted of her blue-collar construction worker father, her washed-out mother, and seven brothers, hell-bent on college in spite of her father's belief that the only things girls learned there was how to stop being virgins and how to throw over the church. She had shed her fair share of tears, and more. And if her own family thought she was hard sometimes, it was because they didn't understand that when you went through hell, you came out baked by the fire, and when you had to burn to have your own way, you always wanted to have it.
"You know something?" Arnie asked.
She shook her head, still feeling the hot, slithery burn of the tears under her lids.
"You'd make me laugh if I wasn't so tired I could hardly stand up. You could have been out there swinging the tire irons and the hammers along with the guys that did it. You're probably happier about it than they are."
"Arnie, that's not fair."
"It is fair," he roared at her, his eyes suddenly blazing with a horrible fire. For the first time in her life, she was afraid of her son. "Your idea to get it out of the driveway. His idea to put it in the airport lot. Who do you think is to blame here? Just who do you think? Do you think it would have happened if it had been here? Huh?"
He took a step toward her, fists clenched at his sides, and she had all she could do to keep from flinching backward.
"Arnie, can't we even talk about this?" she asked. "Like two rational human beings?"
"One of them took a shit on the dashboard of my car," he said coldly. "How's that for rational, Mom?"
She had honestly believed she had the tears under control, but this news, news of such a stupid, irrational fury, brought them back. She cried. She cried in grief for what her son had seen. She lowered her head and cried in bewilderment and pain and fear. All her life as a mother, she had felt secretly superior to the women around her who had children older than Arnie. When he was one, those other mothers had shaken their heads dolefully and told her to wait until he was five. That was when the trouble started. That was when they were old enough to say shit in front of their grandmothers and play with matches when left alone. But Arnold, as good as gold at one, had still been as good as gold at five. Then the other mothers had rolled their eyes and said, "Wait until he's 10. And then it had been 15. That was when it really got sticky. What with the dope and the rock concerts and girls that would do anything and, God forbid, stealing hubcaps and those, well, diseases. And through it all, she had continued to smile inside, because it was all working out according to plan. It was all working out the way she felt her own childhood should have. Her son had warm, supportive parents who cared about him, who would give him anything within reason, who would gladly send him to the college of his choice, as long as it was a good one, thereby finishing the game, business, vocation of parenting with a flourish. If you had suggested that Arnie had few friends and was often bully-ragged by the others, she would have starchily pointed out that she had gone to a parochial school in a tough neighborhood where girls' cotton panties were sometimes torn off for a joke and then set on fire with Zippo lighters engraved with the crucified body of Jesus. And if you had suggested that her own attitudes toward child-rearing differed only in terms of material goals from the attitudes of her hated father, she would have been furious and pointed out her good son as her final vindication. But now her good son stood before her, pale, exhausted, and greased to the elbows, seeming to thrum with the same sort of barely chained anger that had been his grandfather's trademark. Even looking like him, everything seemed to have fallen into a shambles.
"Arnie, we'll talk about what's to be done in the morning," she said, trying to pull herself together and beat back the tears. "We'll talk about it in the morning."
"Not unless you get up real early," he said, seeming to lose interest. "I'm going upstairs and catch about 4 hours, and then I'm going down to the garage again."
"What for?"
He uttered a crazy laugh and flapped his arms under the kitchen's fluorescent bars as if he would fly.
"What do you think for? I got a lot of work to do, more work than you'd believe."
No, you have school tomorrow. I forbid it, Arnie. I absolutely...
He turned to look at her, study her, and she flinched again. This was like some grinding nightmare that was just going to go on and on.
I'll get to school, he said. I'll take some fresh clothes in a pack, and I'll even shower so I don't smell offensive to anyone in homeroom. Then after school's out, I'll go back down to Darnell's. There's a lot of work to be done, but I can do it. I know I can. It's going to eat up a lot of my savings, though. Plus, I'll have to keep on top of the stuff I'm doing for Will.
Your homework? Your studies?
Oh, those. He smiled the dead, mechanical smile of a clockwork figure. They'll suffer, of course. Can't kid you about that. I can't promise you a 93 average anymore, either. But I'll get by. I can make C's, maybe some B's.
No, you've got college to think about.
He came back to the table, limping again, quite badly. He planted his hands on the table before her and leaned slowly down. She thought, a stranger. My son is a stranger to me. Is this really my fault? Is it because I only wanted what was best for him? Can that be? Please, God, make this a nightmare I'll wake up from with tears on my cheeks, because it was so real.
Right now, he said softly, holding her gaze, the only things I care about are Christine and Lee and staying on the good side of Will Darnell so I can get her fixed up as good as new. I don't give a shit about college. And if you don't get off my case, I'll drop out of high school. That ought to shut you up, if nothing else will.
You can't, she said, meeting his gaze. You understand that, Arnold. Maybe I deserve your cruelty, but I'll fight this self-destructive streak of yours with everything I have, so don't you talk about dropping out of school.
But I'll really do it, he answered. I don't want you to even kid yourself into thinking I won't. I'll be 18 in February, and I'll do it on my own then, if you don't stay out of this from now on. Do you understand me?
Go to bed, she said tearfully. Go to bed, you're breaking my heart.
Am I? Shockingly, he laughed. Hurts, doesn't it? I know.
He left then, walking slowly, the limp pulling his body slightly to the left. Shortly she heard the heavy, tired clump of his shoes on the stairs. Also a sound terribly reminiscent of her childhood, when she had thought to herself, the ogre's going to bed. She burst into a fresh spasm of weeping, got up clumsily, and went out the back door to do her crying in private. She held herself, thin comfort but better than none, and looked up at a horned moon that was quadrupled through the film of her tears. Everything had changed, and it had happened with the speed of a cyclone. Her son hated her. She had seen it in his face. It wasn't a tantrum, a temporary peak, a passing squall of adolescence. He hated her, and this wasn't the way it was supposed to go with her good boy. Not at all. Not at all. She stood on the stoop and cried until the tears began to run their course and the sobs became occasional hitchings and gasps. The cold gnawed her bare ankles above her mules and bit more bluntly through her housecoat. She went inside and upstairs. She stood outside Arnie's room indecisively for almost a minute before going in. He had fallen asleep on the coverlet of his bed. His pants were still on. He seemed more unconscious than asleep, and his face looked horribly old. A trick of the light, coming from the hall and falling into the room from over her shoulder, made it seem for a moment to her that his hair was thinning, that his sleep-gaping mouth was without teeth. A small squeal of horror strained itself through the hand clapped to her mouth, and she hurried toward him. Her shadow, which had been on the bed, moved with her, and she saw it was only Arnie. The impression of age no more than the light and her own exhausted confusion. She looked at his clock radio and saw that it was set for 4:30 a.m. She thought of turning the alarm off. She even stretched her hand out to do it. Ultimately, she found she couldn't. Instead, she went down to her bedroom, sat down at the phone table, and picked up the handset. She held it for a moment, debating. If she called Mike in the middle of the night, he would think that something terrible had happened? She giggled. Well, hadn't it? It surely had. And it was still happening. She dialed the number of the Ramada Inn in Kansas City, where her husband was staying, vaguely aware that she was, for the first time since she had left the grim and grimy three-story house in Roxburgh for college 27 years before, calling for help. Chapter 28. Lee Makes a Visit. She got through most of the story okay, sitting in one of the two visitors' chairs with her knees pressed firmly together and her ankles crossed, neatly dressed in a multicolored wool sweater and a brown corduroy skirt. It was not until the end that she began to cry, and she couldn't find a handkerchief. Dennis Gilder handed her the box of tissues from the table beside the bed. "Take it easy, Lee," he said.
"I can. He hasn't been to see me. And in school he just seems so tired. And you said he hasn't been here."
"He'll come if he needs me," Dennis said.
You're full of macho bullshit, she said,
and then looked comically stunned at what she had said. The tears had cut tracks in the light makeup she was wearing. She and Dennis looked at each other for a moment, and then they laughed. But it was brief laughter, and not really that good. "Has Motormouth seen him?" Dennis asked.
"Who?"
"Motormouth. That's what Larry Baron calls Mr. Vickers, the guidance counselor."
"Oh, yes, I think he has. He was called to the guidance office the day before yesterday, Monday. But he didn't say anything, and I didn't dare ask him anything. He won't talk. He's gotten so strange."
Dennis nodded. Although he didn't think Lee realized it, she was deep in her own trouble and confusion, he felt a sense of impotence and a deepening fear for Arnie. From the reports that had filtered into his room over the last few days, Arnie sounded on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Lee's report was only the most recent and the most graphic. He had never wanted to be out as badly as he did now. Of course, he could call Vickers and ask him if there was anything he could do, and he could call Arnie. Except from what Lee had said, Arnie was now always at school, at Darnell's, or sleeping. His father had come home early from some sort of convention, and there had been another fight, Lee had told him. Although Arnie had not come right out and said so, Lee told Dennis she believed that he had come very close to simply leaving home. Dennis didn't want to talk to Arnie at Darnell's.
"What can I do?" she asked him. "What would you do in my place?"
"Wait," Dennis said. "I don't know what else you can do."
"But that's hardest,"
she answered, in a voice so low it was almost inaudible. Her hands were clenching and unclenching on the Kleenex, shredding it, dotting her brown skirt with speckles of lint.
"My folks want me to stop seeing him, to drop him. They're afraid that Repperton and those other boys will do something else."
"You're pretty sure it was Buddy and his friends, huh?"
"Yes, everybody is. Mr. Cunningham called the police, even though Arnie told him not to. He said he'd settle the score in his own way, and that scared them both. It scares me, too. The police picked up Buddy Repperton and one of his friends, the one they called Moochie. Do you know who I mean?"
"Yes."
"And the boy who works nights at the airport parking lot. They picked him up too. Galton, his name is?"
"Sandy."
"They thought he must have been in on it, that maybe he let them in."
"He runs with them all right," Dennis said. "But he's not quite as degenerate as the rest of them. I'll say this, Lee. If Arnie didn't talk to you, someone sure did."
"First Mrs. Cunningham and then his father.
I don't think either of them knew the other one had talked to me. They're...
upset, Dennis suggested. She shook her head.
It's more than that, she said. They both look like they were just mugged or something. I can't really feel sorry for her. All she wants is her own way, I think. But I could cry for Mr. Cunningham. He just seems so...
She trailed off and then began again.
When I got there yesterday afternoon after school, Mrs. Cunningham, she asked me to call her Regina, but I just can't seem to do it.
Dennis grinned.
Can you do it? Lee asked.
Well, yeah, but I've had a lot more practice. She smiled, the first good one of her visit.
Maybe that would make a difference. Anyway, when I went over, she was there, but Mr. Cunningham was still at school. The university, I mean.
Yeah.
She took the whole week off, what there is of it. She said she couldn't go back, even for the 3 days before Thanksgiving.
How does she look?
She looked shattered, Lee said, and reached for a fresh Kleenex. She began shredding the edges. She looks 10 years older than when I first met her a month ago.
And him, Michael?
Older, but tougher, Lee said hesitantly, as if this had somehow gotten him into gear.
Dennis was silent. He had known Michael Cunningham for 13 years, and had never seen him in gear, so he wouldn't know. Regina had always been the one in gear. Michael trailed along in her wake and made the drinks at the parties, mostly faculty parties, the Cunninghams hosted. He played his recorder. He looked melancholy. But by no stretch of the imagination could Dennis say he had ever seen the man in gear. The final triumph, Dennis's father had said once, standing at the window and watching Regina lead Arnie by the hand down the Gilder's Walk to where Michael waited behind the wheel of the car. Arnie and Dennis had been perhaps 7 then. Momism supreme. I wonder if she'll make the poor slob wait in the car when Arnie gets married. Or maybe she can... Dennis's mother had frowned at her husband and shushed him by cutting her eyes at Dennis in a little pitchers have big ears gesture. He never forgot the gesture or what his father had said. At 7, he hadn't understood all of it, but even at 7, he knew perfectly well what a poor slob was. And even at 7, he vaguely understood why his father might think Michael Cunningham was one. He had felt sad for Michael Cunningham, and that feeling had held off and on, right up to the present.
He came in around the time she was finishing her story, Lee went on. They asked me to stay for supper. Arnie has been eating down at Darnell's, but I told him I really had to get back. So Mr. Cunningham offered me a ride, and I got his side on the way home.
Are they on different sides?
Not exactly, but Mr. Cunningham was the one who went to see the police, for instance. Arnie didn't want to, and Mrs. Cunningham, Regina, couldn't bring herself to do it.
Dennis asked cautiously, "He's really trying to put Humpty back together again, huh?"
"Yes,"
she whispered, and then burst out shrilly.
"But that's not all. He's in deep with that guy, Darnell. I know he is. Yesterday in Period 3 study hall, he told me he was going to drop a new front end into his car this afternoon and this evening, and I said, 'Won't that be awfully expensive, Arnie?' And he said not to worry about it because his credit was good."
"Slow down." She was crying again.
"His credit was good because he and someone named Jimmy Sykes were going to do some errands for Will Friday and Saturday. That's what he said, and I don't think the errands he does for that son of a bitch are legal."
"What did he tell the police when they came to ask about Christine?"
"He told them about finding it that way. They asked him if he had any ideas who might have done it, and Arnie said no. They asked him if it wasn't true that he had gotten into a fight with Buddy Repperton, that Repperton had pulled a knife and had been expelled for it. Arnie said that Repperton had knocked his bag lunch out of his hand and stepped on it. Then Mr. Casey came over from the shop and broke it up. They asked him if Repperton hadn't said he would get him for it,
And Arnie said he might have said something like that, but talk was cheap.
Dennis was silent, looking out his window at a dull November sky, considering this. He found it ominous. If Lee had the interview with the police right, then Arnie hadn't told a single lie. But he had edited things to make what had happened in the smoking area sound like your ordinary pushy-pushy. Dennis found that extremely ominous.
"Do you know what Arnie might be doing for that man, Darnell?" Lee asked.
"No," Dennis answered, but he had some ideas. A little internal tape recorder started up, and he heard his father saying, "I've heard a few things. Stolen cars, cigarettes and booze, contraband-like fireworks. He's been lucky for a long time, Dennis." He looked at Lee's face, too pale, her makeup cut open by her tears. She was hanging on to Arnie as best she could. Maybe she was learning something about being tough that she wouldn't have learned otherwise with her looks for another 10 years. But that didn't make it any easier, and it didn't necessarily make it right. It occurred to him suddenly, almost randomly, that he had first noticed the improvement in Arnie's face more than a month before Arnie and Lee clicked, but after Arnie and Christine had clicked. "I'll talk to him," he promised.
"Good," she said.
She stood up.
I don't want things to be like they were before, Dennis. I know nothing ever is, but I still love him, and I just wish you'd tell him that."
"Yeah, okay." They were both embarrassed, and neither of them could say anything for a long, long moment. Dennis was thinking that this would be the point in a C&W song where the best friend steps in, and a sneaking, mean, and randy part of him wouldn't be averse to that. Not at all. He was still powerfully attracted to her, more attracted than he had been to any girl in a long time. Maybe ever. Let Arnie run bottle rockets and cherry bombs over to Burlington and fuck around with his car. He and Lee could get to know each other better in the meantime. A little aid and comfort, you know how it is. And he had a feeling at just that awkward moment, after her profession of love for Arnie, that he could do it. She was vulnerable. She was maybe learning how to be tough, but it's not a school anyone goes to willingly. He could say something, the right something, maybe only, "Come here." And she would come, sit on the edge of the bed. They would talk some more, maybe about pleasanter things, and maybe he would kiss her. Her mouth was lovely and full, sensual, made to kiss and be kissed. Once for comfort, twice out of friendship, and 3 times pays for all. Yes, he felt with an instinct that had so far been quite reliable that it could be done. But he didn't say any of the things that could have started those things happening, and neither did Lee. Arnie was between them, and almost surely always would be. Arnie and his lady. If it hadn't been so ludicrously ghastly, he could have laughed.
"When are they letting you out?" she asked.
"On an unsuspecting public?" he asked, and began to giggle. After a moment, she joined him in his laughter.
"Yes, something like that," Lee said, and then snickered again. "Sorry."
"Don't be," Dennis said. "People have been laughing at me all my life. I'm used to it. They say I'm stuck here until January, but I'm gonna fool them. I'm going home for Christmas. I'm working my buns off down in the torture chamber."
"Torture chamber?"
"Physical therapy. My back's looking good. The other bones are knitting busily. The itch is terrible sometimes. I'm gobbling rose hips by the bushel basket. Dr. Arroway says that's nothing but a folk tale, but Coach Puffer swears by them, and he checks the bottle every time he comes to visit."
"Does he come often, the coach?"
"Yeah, he does. Now he's got me half believing that stuff about rose hips making your broken bones knit faster." Dennis paused. "Of course, I'm not gonna be playing any more football. Not ever. I'm gonna be on crutches for a while, and then, with luck, I'll graduate to a cane. Cheerful old Dr. Arroway tells me I'm gonna limp for maybe a couple of years. Or maybe I'll always limp."
"I'm so sorry," she said in a low voice. I'm sorry it had to happen to a nice guy like you, Dennis, but part of it's selfish. I just wonder if all the rest of this, all this horrible stuff with Arnie, if it would have happened if you'd been up and around.
That's right, Dennis said, rolling his eyes dramatically. Blame it on me.
But she didn't smile. I've started to worry about his sanity. Did you know that? That's the one thing I haven't told my folks or his folks, but I think his mother, that she might... I don't know what he said to her that night after we found the car all smashed up, but I think they must have really put their claws into each other.
Dennis nodded.
But it's all so mad. His parents offered to buy him a good used car to replace Christine, and he said no. Then Mr. Cunningham told me on the ride home that he offered to buy Arnie a new car to cash in some bonds he's held ever since 1955. Arnie said no. He couldn't just take a present like that. And Mr. Cunningham said he could understand that, and it didn't have to be a present, that Arnie could pay him back, that he'd even take interest if that was what Arnie wanted. Dennis, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, Dennis said. It can't be just any car. It's got to be that car. Christine.
But to me that seems obsessive. He's found one object and fixed on it. Isn't that what an obsession is? I'm scared, and sometimes I feel hateful. But it's not him I'm scared of. It's not him I hate. It's that frig... No, it's that fucking car. That bitch, Christine.
High color bloomed in her cheeks. Her eyes narrowed. The corners of her mouth turned down. Her face was suddenly no longer beautiful, not even pretty. The light on it was pitiless, changing it into something that was ugly, but all the same striking, compelling. Dennis realized for the first time why they called it the monster, the green-eyed monster.
I'll tell you what I wish would happen, Lee said. I wish somebody would take his precious fucking Christine out back some night by mistake, out where they put the junks from Philly Plains.
Her eyes sparkled venomously.
And the next day I wish that crane with the big round magnet would come and pick it up and put it in the crusher. And I wish someone would push the button, and what would come out would be a little cube of metal about 3 by 3 by 3. Then this would be over, wouldn't it?
Dennis didn't answer. And after a moment he could almost see the monster turn around and wrap its scaly tail around itself and steal out of her face. Her shoulders sagged.
Guess that sounds pretty horrible, doesn't it? Like saying I wish those hoods had finished the job.
I understand how you feel.
Do you?
She challenged. Dennis thought of Arnie's look as he had pounded his fists on the dashboard, the kind of maniacal light that came into his eyes when he was around her. He thought of sitting behind the wheel in LeBay's garage and the kind of vision that had come over him. Last of all, he thought of his dream. Headlights bearing down on him in the high woman scream of burning rubber.
Yes, he said. I think I do.
They looked at each other in the hospital room. Chapter 29. Thanksgiving. At the hospital, they served Thanksgiving dinner in shifts from 11 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. Dennis got his at 12:15, 3 careful slices of white turkey breast, 1 careful ladleful of brown gravy, a scoop of instant mashed potatoes the exact size and shape of a baseball, lacking only the red stitches, he thought with sour amusement, a like scoop of frozen squash that was an arrogant fluorescent orange, and a small plastic container of cranberry jelly. For dessert, there was ice cream. Resting on the corner of his tray was a small blue card. Wise to the ways of the hospital by now, once you have been treated for the first set of bed sores to crop up on your ass, Dennis had discovered, you're wiser to the ways of the hospital than you ever wanted to be. He asked the candy striper who came to take away his tray what the yellow and red cards got for their Thanksgiving dinner. It turned out that the yellow cards got 2 pieces of turkey, no gravy, potato, no squash, and jello for dessert. The red cards got 1 slice of white meat, pureed, and potato. Fed to them,
in most cases. Dennis found it all pretty depressing. It was only too easy to imagine his mother bringing a great, big, crackling capon to the dining room table around 4 in the afternoon, his father sharpening his carving knife, his sister, flushed with importance and excitement, a red velvet ribbon in her hair, pouring each of them a glass of good red wine. It was also easy to imagine the good smells, the laughter as they sat down. Easy to imagine, but probably a mistake. It was, in fact, the most depressing Thanksgiving of his life. He drifted off into an unaccustomed early afternoon nap, no physical therapy because of the holiday, and dreamed an unsettling dream in which several candy stripers walked through the IC ward and slapped turkey decals onto the life support machinery and IV drips. His mother, father, and sister had come over to visit for an hour in the morning, and for the first time he had sensed in Ellie an anxiousness to be gone. They had been invited over to the Callisons for a light Thanksgiving brunch, and Lou Callison, one of the 3 Callison boys, was 14 and cute. Her racked-up brother had become boring. They hadn't discovered a rare and tragic form of cancer breeding in his bones. He wasn't going to be paralyzed for the rest of his life. There was no movie of the week in him. They had called him from the Callisons around 12:30, and his father sounded a bit drunk. Dennis guessed he was maybe on his second Bloody Mary, and was maybe getting some disapproving looks from Mom. Dennis himself had just been finishing up his dietitian-approved, blue-carded Thanksgiving dinner, the only such dinner he had ever been able to finish in 15 minutes. And he did a good job of sounding cheerful, not wanting to spoil their good time. Ellie came on the wire briefly, sounding giggly and rather screaming. Maybe it was talking to Ellie that had tired him out enough to need a nap. He had fallen asleep and had his unsettling dream around 2 o'clock. The hospital was unusually quiet today, running on a skeleton staff. The usual babble of TVs and transistor radios from the other rooms was muted. The candy striper who took his tray smiled brightly and said she hoped that he had enjoyed his special dinner. Dennis assured her that he had. After all, it was Thanksgiving for her, too. And so he dreamed. And the dream broke up and became a darker sleep. And when he woke up, it was nearly 5 o'clock, and Arnie Cunningham was sitting on the hard plastic contour chair where his girl had sat only the day before. Dennis was not at all surprised to see him there. He simply assumed that it was a new dream. "Hi, Arnie," he said. "How's it hanging?"
"Hanging good," Arnie said. "But you look like you're still asleep, Dennis. Want some head noogies? That'll wake you up."
There was a brown bag on his lap, and Dennis's sleepy mind thought, "Got his lunch after all. Maybe Repperton didn't squash it as bad as we thought." He tried to sit up in the bed, hurt his back, and used the control panel to get into what was almost a sitting position. The motor whined.
"Jesus, it's really you. Were you expecting Ghidra, the three-headed monster?"
Arnie asked amiably.
"I was sleeping. I guess I thought I still was."
Dennis rubbed his forehead hard, as if to get rid of the sleep behind it.
"Happy Thanksgiving, Arnie."
"You bet,"
Arnie said.
"Same to you. Did they feed you turkey with all the trimmings?"
Dennis laughed. "I got something that looked like those play dinners that came with Ellie's Happy Time cafeteria when she was about 7, remember?" Arnie put his cupped hands to his mouth and made ralphing noises.
"I remember. What a gross out."
"I'm really glad you came," Dennis said, and for a moment he was perilously close to tears. Maybe he hadn't realized just how depressed he had been. He redoubled his determination to be home by Christmas. If he was here on Christmas Day, he'd probably commit suicide.
"Your folks didn't come?"
"Sure they did," Dennis said, "and they'll be back again tonight. Mom and Dad will be anyway, but it's not the same. You know."
"Yeah. Well, I brought some stuff. Told the lady downstairs I had your bathrobe."
Arnie giggled a little.
"What is that?"
Dennis asked, nodding at the bag. It wasn't just a lunch bag, he saw. It was a shopping bag.
"I raided the fridge after we ate the bird," Arnie said. "My mom and Dad went around visiting their friends from the university. They do that every year on Thanksgiving afternoon. They won't even be back until around 8.
As he talked, he took things out of the bag. Dennis watched, amazed, two pewter candle holders, two candles. Arnie slammed the candles into the holders, lit them with a matchbook advertising Darnell's Garage, and turned off the overhead light. Then, four sandwiches, clumsily wrapped in waxed paper.
"The way I recall it," Arnie said, "you always said that scarfing up a couple of turkey sandwiches around 11:30 Thursday night was better than Thanksgiving dinner anyway, because the pressure was off."
"Yeah," Dennis said. "Sandwiches in front of the TV, Carson or some old movie, but honest to God, Arnie, you didn't have to."
"Ah, shit. I haven't even been around to see you in almost 3 weeks. Good thing for me you were sleeping when I came in, or you probably would have shot me."
He tapped Dennis's two sandwiches.
"Your favorite, I think. White meat and mayo and Wonder Bread?"
Dennis got giggling at that, then laughing, then roaring. Arnie could see it hurt his back, but he couldn't stop. Wonder Bread had been one of Arnie and Dennis's great common secrets as children. Both of their mothers had been very serious about the subject of bread. Regina bought diet thin loaves, with an occasional side trip into the land of stone ground rye. Dennis's mother favored Roman meal and pumpernickel loaves. Arnie and Dennis ate what was given them. But both were secret Wonder Bread freaks. And on more than one occasion, they had pooled their money, and instead of buying sweets, they had gotten a loaf of Wonder and a jar of French's mustard. They would then slink out into Arnie's garage, or Dennis's treehouse, sadly demolished in a windstorm almost 9 years before, and gobble mustard sandwiches and read Richie Rich comic books until the whole loaf was gone. Arnie joined him in his laughter, and for Dennis, that was the best part of Thanksgiving. Dennis had been between roommates for almost 10 days, and so had the semi-private room to himself. Arnie closed the door and produced a six-pack of Busch beer from the brown bag. "Wonders will never cease," Dennis said, and had to laugh again at the unintentional pun.
"No," Arnie said, "I don't think they ever will."
He toasted Dennis over the candles with a bottle of beer.
"Prost."
"Live forever,"
Dennis responded. They drank. After they'd finished the thick turkey sandwiches, Arnie produced two plastic Tupperware pie wedges from his apparently bottomless bag and pried off the lids. Two pieces of homemade apple pie rested within.
"No, man, I can't," Dennis said. "I'll bust."
"Eat,"
Arnie commanded.
"I really can't,"
Dennis said, taking the Tupperware container and a fresh plastic fork. He finished the slice of pie in four huge bites and then belched. He upended the remainder of his second beer and belched again.
"In Portugal, that's a compliment to the cook," he said.
His head was buzzing pleasantly from the beer.
"Whatever you say,"
Arnie responded with a grin. He got up, turned on the overhead fluorescent, and snuffed the candles. Outside, a steady rain had begun to beat against the windows. It looked and sounded cold. And for Dennis, some of the warm spirit of friendship and real Thanksgiving seemed to go out with the candles.
"I'm gonna hate you tomorrow," Dennis said. "I'll probably have to sit on that John in there for an hour, and it hurts my back."
"You remember the time Elaine got the farts?"
Arnie asked, and they both laughed.
"We teased her until your mother gave us holy old hell."
"They didn't smell, but they sure were loud," Dennis said, smiling.
"Like gunshots,"
Arnie agreed. And they both laughed a little. But it was a sad sort of laughter, if there is such a thing. A lot of water under the bridge. The thought that Ellie's attack of the farts had happened 7 years ago was somehow more unsettling than it was amusing. There was a breath of mortality in the realization that 7 years could steal past with such smooth and unobtrusive ease. Conversation lapsed a little, both of them lost in their own thoughts. At last, Dennis said, "Lee came by yesterday. Told me about Christine. I'm sorry, man. Bummer." Arnie looked up, and his expression of thoughtful melancholy was lost in a cheerful smile that Dennis didn't really believe.
"Yeah," he said. "It was screwed. But I went way overboard about it."
"Anybody would," Dennis said, aware that he had become suddenly watchful,
hating it, but unable to help it. The friendship part was over. It had been here, warming the room and filling it, and now it had simply slipped away, like the effect.